Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the most high-profile cases in the Boston Catholic Church sex abuse scandal is going to trial in Cambridge, Massachusetts today. Defrocked priest Paul Shanley is accused of raping a child in the 1980s while he was a priest at a church in the Boston suburb of Newton. The alleged victim is now 27 years old and claims Shanley abused him between the ages of 6 and 11. Well, Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff is at the courthouse in Cambridge. Monica, opening statements just wrapped up. What are the lawyers saying so far?
Well, Robin, the assistant district attorney laid out a story in which he said in 1983, a six-year-old boy sat in his church waiting. She said he was ready, he was afraid, and he knew that his priest would come week after week. Then she pointed in the courtroom to Father Paul Shanley, who's now defrocked, and said he raped this young boy in the church's pews, in the bathroom, in the rectory, in the confessional, over a period of 6 years. And she repeated one phrase over and over, that Paul Shanley allegedly told the victim, "If you tell, no one will believe you." She said this was done almost 20 years ago, and at that time, she just kept saying, "If you tell, no one will believe you." Especially, she said, because Father Shanley at the time was adored, everyone loved him, but she said there was another side to Paul Shanley. Now, in the defense's opening statements, he came to the podium and said this case is about two things: old memories and really old memories. And he said that his theme throughout all of this is that this happened 20 years ago. People have told different versions of the story at different times, and it really based on the crux of the matter of recovering memories, because this alleged victim said he didn't recover this memory until just 2 years ago.
We'll have more on that issue in a moment, but we know that Shanley now faces three charges of raping a child. The charges could have been much graver. Three other alleged victims dropped out. All of the alleged victims in the Shanley case have collected a reported $300,000 or more as a result of a settlement with the Catholic Church. Why haven't there been more criminal cases, though?
Well, there aren't more criminal cases against priests in this clergy sexual abuse scandal for one reason, primarily, and that's the statute of limitations that presents a time limit from the time the alleged incident took place to when you can bring charges. And most of these allegations happened years ago. Now, in this case of Paul Shanley, the clock on the statute of limitations was frozen because he moved out of state from Massachusetts to California and then to New York. And that means that these charges of rape and indecent assault and battery were frozen in time. Now, the prosecution did have three other alleged victims and originally a much larger case against Paul Shanley, who was really painted as like the poster boy bad priest for the clergy sexual abuse scandal. But over time, these charges looked weaker and weaker, and the prosecution decided to drop two of them in July and then dropped a third one just a week ago because the alleged victim is apparently homeless and he's on substance abuse. He has substance abuse problems and couldn't be located for trial.
Well, now, Monica, I want to get you quickly to this issue of recovered memories. The Shanley case hinges on that. The accuser says he recalled the abuse in 2002, nearly 20 years after it happened. Tell us what you've found.
Well, really, experts say things are on both sides of this issue, whether the recovered memories issue is keen or not. And before the beginning of this trial, I researched the issue of recovered memories and how they are viewed in the medical community.
It's not uncommon for girls and boys to forget at some point that they had been abused in childhood and even to later recall that memory.
Linda Williams, director of research at the Wellesley Centers for Women, says children who are abused often don't have a context for understanding what happened to them, so they easily forget about it.
Although most people, you know, you might say unfortunately, remember all their lives and are reminded about it frequently, many people don't.
Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, the director of the Trauma Center in Boston, explains how a person can forget.
The brain at a moment of very high arousal shuts down certain parts of that are necessary to create verbal memories.
Without a story behind the memory, Dr. van der Kolk says patients he sees have unexplainable sensations and reactions until they fully recall their memories. But there is much debate over the reality and extent of recovered memories. Williams at Wellesley College is author of a 1994 study that she says provides the strongest evidence that recovered memories are valid. Interviewers followed up with adults who, as children, had documented cases of sexual abuse. In the study, 38% of the girls and 55% of the boys did not recall their abuse. And Williams says others said they had forgotten the abuse until something triggered their memory.
One woman in our research told us about the fact that she had been watching the Oprah Winfrey Show. Up until that time, she had no recollection that any abuse experience had happened to her. And then she goes, oh my gosh, that's exactly what happened to me.
She then told the interviewer details of the abuse exactly the same as they were recorded in her medical chart from decades earlier. But other researchers say recovered memories are not reliable and are sometimes false.
There's not a shred of scientific evidence to support the idea that people commonly repress memories from childhood.
Dr. August Piper, a psychiatrist from Seattle, Washington, is on the advisory board of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. He says there are many studies that provide strong evidence against repressed memories.
One can easily always find competing explanations for the alleged phenomenon of repression. For example, the person chooses not to think about it, or the person forgets the event, as all of us forget things.
Piper says usually overzealous or ill-trained therapists implant false memories in people's minds. In the Paul Shanley trial, the defense plans to call one of the leading experts on false memory to the stand. In a criminal trial, it's difficult to prove recovered memories, says Dr. Paul Applebaum of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's an expert on psychiatry and the legal system.
I think the experience over the last decade has been that courts, including both judges and juries, have become increasingly skeptical of memories that are forgotten and then recovered at some later point.
He says that's because all memories, whether they are continuous or recovered, are malleable and subject to being revised by subsequent experiences.
The fact that a memory has been repressed and recovered, or even when it's been maintained continuously, doesn't mean it's true. We all have many memories that are invalid.
Back at the Middlesex Courthouse now at the Paul Shanley trial, on the stand are priests from the Boston Archdiocese talking about his employment with the Archdiocese. And tomorrow we can expect to hear from the alleged victim on the witness stand. Robin?
Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff speaking to us from the Middlesex Superior Courthouse in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Monica, thanks for keeping us updated.
You're welcome.
Polls show that most people in the state of Connecticut want admitted serial killer Michael Ross dead, as does Michael Ross, who has ended his death row appeals. But his execution, which had been scheduled for 2 Eastern time tomorrow morning, has been postponed a day by a federal judge. State prosecutors are appealing, but if he is executed, Michael Ross would become the first person put to death in New England in nearly 45 years. Joining us on the line is Mark Pazniokas, a reporter for the Hartford Courant. And Mark, how big is this case and the debate surrounding it in Connecticut?
The case has dominated the news in Connecticut for weeks, really. Although it does not seem to have really dominated the public. Mm-hmm. There's been very little public presence at the legislature or outside the courts.
We understand the polls, though, show that most people in Connecticut do want Michael Ross put to death. He's accused of murdering 8 young women in Connecticut and New York in the early 80s. Why is he saying he wants to die? I mean, why now? He spent 17 years fighting his execution.
Well, I suppose the best thing to do is look at his own words. He, in recent years, has there's evidence of despondency, and that's an issue that's being argued in court. What is his mental state? But he wrote one friend in late 2002 that the quote was, "Death is easy. It's my life that's a bitch to live. I can't do this much longer. It's too hard. I'm so tired. Eternal rest seems like a pretty good deal right now."
Well, but so what are the people saying who are, fighting his demand to be put to death? Because I can see, people in Connecticut saying, well, that's how someone might feel if they were on death row. Does that necessarily mean that he's despondent or has some mental incapacity?
The people fighting his execution are doing so largely for reasons that have little or nothing to do with Michael Ross himself. This would be the first execution in Connecticut since 1960. The death penalty statute in the state has changed several times since then. It has not been tested in any type of review by the federal appellate courts, including the Supreme Court. So the opponents of the death penalty view this case as very important. This is the case where they would like to really test all aspects of Connecticut's death penalty statute to see if they are defective in any way.
Right. They include religious human rights groups. We understand Ross's father. Well, yesterday a federal judge said he did not think Michael Ross was competent to decide to end his appeals. Now, why is that? Because this case, as we said, has been going through the courts for years.
Judge Robert Schotteny yesterday looked at the previous proceedings. There was one hearing held on Ross's mental competency in the Connecticut Superior Courts. And the problem with that proceeding is it was considered to be one-sided. The public defenders who are opposing Ross's execution do not have legal standing in the courts to be involved. And the Superior Court judge who conducted the competency hearing said since they don't have standing, they cannot participate. So there was a psychiatrist who had examined Ross for the state. He was questioned in open court on his examination of Ross, but he was only questioned by the government, by the prosecution. There was not an adversarial proceeding. So when this got to federal court yesterday, that was an issue. Judge Schotteny looked at this and said, was this truly a thorough competency hearing since you did not have lawyers who oppose his execution aggressively challenging the findings of the doctor? This was a doctor, Michael Norco. Mm-hmm. One area that was not examined in the state competency hearing was, what are the psychological effects of a long, isolating confinement, such as Ross has experienced?
How long?
Well, he's been locked up since 1984, and he has been on death row much of that time. He was sentenced to death in 1987. It was reversed in 94, and then it was reinstated. But pretty much during that time, he was either on death row or in a similarly confining setting. Connecticut has a prison that's considered a super maximum prison where prisoners there are in lockdown 23 hours of the day.
Well, Mark Pasniokas, again, a reporter for the Hartford Courant, this complicated nature that you're describing us is probably why this could end up with the U.S. Supreme Court. If an appeals court overturns the federal judge's decision to stay the execution, we might see it go all the way to the top. Mark, thank you so much for filling us in.
You're welcome.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a closer look at the issue of the death penalty nationwide. You know, we said that polls in Connecticut favored Michael Ross's execution. Well, that bucks a national trend, turning on capital punishment. We'll tell you more when we come back. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about the death penalty. A reminder, admitted serial killer Michael Ross wants to be put to death in Connecticut on Thursday as scheduled, but legal challenges may stop his execution. Now, 38 states have death penalty laws on the books, but since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976, no one has been put to death in states north or east of Pennsylvania. Well, joining us on the line is Richard Dieter. He's executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. They research the death penalty, and they are critical of how it's implemented while taking no stand on the issue on moral grounds. And Richard, how many death row prisoners want to end their appeals, as Michael Ross does?
Well, last year, of the people who were executed, there were 59, 16% actually waived their appeals at their last stages. Overall, there's been over 900 executions in the U.S. since the death penalty was reinstated, and about 11% of the people, so, you know, over 100, waived their appeals, at least at the last stages. In other words, they could have prevented their own execution, but wanted to go forward.
What are the legal rights of groups that want to stay the execution of someone like Michael Ross, who wants to go forth with it?
Well, the big question is whether a group has standing to come before the court. After all, this is not their issue or their case. Now, if a person, a defendant, the person who's about to be executed, is incompetent to raise his own defense, then others can do it for him.
Yeah. Well, what's your sense? How do you square the fact that polls show that people across Connecticut support his plea for an execution? They also want him killed. When Connecticut hasn't put anyone to death in nearly 45 years, how do you square that with the national polls that show that support for the death penalty is actually dropping nationally?
I think when you ask somebody in Connecticut or any state that has the death penalty and present them with the facts like the Michael Ross case, you're asking if the death penalty applies to anybody, should it apply to him, given these facts? And I think people tend to say yes. It's different when you ask them, what's the appropriate punishment for first-degree murder, death, or life without possibility of parole? And in polls in Connecticut and around the country, that changes the results significantly. People are much more split. In particular, the Quinnipiac poll in Connecticut said more would favor life without parole, and that's the trend around the country.
And why do you think that support for the death penalty has dropped, we hear, by maybe 50% in the last few years? Why?
Well, clearly what's happened over the past 5 years is a revelation about mistakes with the death penalty. There have been a total now of 117 people freed from death row. Many of them in recent years were because of DNA testing, which is a real clear scientific test that the state had the wrong person and yet almost executed them. Death sentences have dropped by 50%. Executions have dropped by 40%. Death row is down where it had been rising every year. So the numbers are all in one direction on the death penalty.
And yet we read that California is considering building a new death row wing.
Yes, right. You know, I think that's somewhat symbolic of what we're experiencing, that there's this ambivalence. People want the death penalty on the books, you know, just in case. But executions are much more controversial and rare phenomena outside of a few states in the South.
And so the appeals process has sort of taken over for the actual execution. And critics of that would say, just make it quicker, more efficient, and less expensive.
Yes, but then you run into the risk of executing an innocent person. I mean, clearly, the people who were freed from death row, it took an average of 9 years to discover those cases. If you cut the appeals process down to 5 years, half of those innocent people would have been executed.
Richard Dieter, as you look ahead, you mentioned the DNA, which has exonerated up to 100 inmates in the last few years. What happens when DNA confirms somebody's guilt or innocence?
Well, it certainly is a two-edged sword. It certainly can result in kind of the jury being more sure than just, say, eyewitnesses. But the average murder is not a DNA case. Matter of fact, only a quarter of these murder cases involve DNA. So we're still going to have the majority of cases depending on quasi-reliable evidence. And you always can make a mistake. And even with DNA, you can make mistakes.
Let's take a look at where some aspects of the death penalty stand. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule this year on juvenile executions. Which case is that, briefly? And where is it thought the ruling might go?
Well, the case is Roper versus Simmons. It comes out of Missouri, where the Missouri Supreme Court felt that the country had changed and we no longer could allow execution of those under the age of 18 at the time of their crime. And now the U.S. Supreme Court is about to decide it. They decided a similar case 2 years ago and said it's unconstitutional to execute the mentally retarded because of their limitations mentally and responsibly. I think the same things apply to the juveniles, the same lineup of justices. I think we'll see a decision which will say that the country has turned aside from those kinds of executions.
And bringing it back to the case of Michael Roth in Connecticut, a serial killer who's admitted to the rape and murder of several women and wants to be put to death, is there ever in your mind a system that could just be, for those who want it?
Well, even a death penalty system for those who want it has got risks. There have been many people, surprising as it may sound, who have confessed to things that they didn't do. So if the criteria is, let the criminal decide if he wants to die, we'll probably be also executing innocent people, even though they want to commit suicide. We don't generally support suicide in society, and I don't know that we should do so here, but there isn't any system that says, we'll just get the right people. We've tried this. We've tried the death penalty for years and years, and its problems, are clear and persistent. We can still have the death penalty with all of that, but, we should know that we're not going to have a foolproof system or somehow define the cases that are the ones everybody agrees on. I just don't think that's possible.
Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Richard, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, anti-Semitism in Europe on the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Congressional Budget Office is predicting today that the government will run a deficit of $855 billion over the next 10 years. But today's projections don't include President Bush's plan to revamp Social Security. Also not included, the $80 billion President Bush is expected to ask from Congress to continue fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Douglas Holtz Aiken is director of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. He joins us on the line from Washington. Douglas, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And when we last spoke, last September, the CBO projected a 10-year deficit of $2.3 trillion. That's a lot more than the 10-year figure of $855 billion that you're releasing today. So do that math for us. I mentioned the war and the Social Security. Is that making up the difference? What's not in your budget today?
Well, what's largely driving the difference is the treatment of spending for Iraq and Afghanistan. The way CBO puts together its baseline budget projections is to take all the policies that are on the books and keep them on the books for the 10 years over which Congress does its planning. In September, when we did our outlook, there was $115 billion in funding for Iraq, Afghanistan, and other kinds of activities in the war on terrorism. And we put that on the books, kept it for 10 years, raised it at the rate of inflation. It contributed $1.4 trillion to the total deficit. Mm. At the moment, we have zero. So there's a big swing there, $1.4 trillion down to zero. That drives the apparent improvement in the 10-year budget outlook. The reality underneath that is that the outlook is modestly worse than it was at the time.
Right. Well, and crunch some of those numbers for us. Do you have the estimates of what, for instance, the continued war in Iraq and Afghanistan and revamping Social Security would cost?
We don't really know what either of those numbers will be, and for similar reasons. In both cases, while they're important policy topics and certainly the object of a great deal of discussion, the future is very difficult to tell. Iraq and Afghanistan are a bit easier. We know that the kinds of troops that we have in the area, about 200,000 total overseas, are likely to be there for a year or more. And so we could anticipate that for this year, we'd get about $30 billion in additional costs. That would put the federal deficit at about $400 billion, which is a modest improvement over last year's $412. But going forward, it's very hard to tell what is next. Right. It will depend on how quickly we exit from Iraq. It will depend, more importantly, on the degree to which those spending needs are replaced by others in the war on terrorism, other effects.
Well, but you have put a price tag on possibly revamping Social Security, haven't you? Am I reading that correctly?
Well, what we've done in the past is take a look at the plan put out by the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, what's known as Commission Plan 2. Our price tag there was a long-term analysis that looked at whether it came back to solvency. Did the fact that revenues are well below the spending promise that Social Security ever close? The answer is yes in our analysis of that plan. Unfortunately, we don't know if that's what the White House will propose, and we don't know many of the important details that will determine how that interacts with the rest of the budget.
Right. Well, but I'll jump in with some numbers because others have. Some have said they could cost between $1 and $2 trillion to revamp Social Security.
Any reform of Social Security is what I'd like to think of as a two-step dance. Step one in the dance is, what do you do to the traditional Social Security program? It is this program, the one where the many boomers who are about to retire will enter and receive benefits that far outstrip the revenues dedicated to that system. It's this program that will produce a lot of budgetary pressure in the future. So you have to think about what happens to that program.
And
step
yet,
two is mm-hmm. the important step that everyone seems to want to go to, and that is, let's rethink Social Security and perhaps put in individual accounts, pre-fund each person's retirement, at least in part, and there you might borrow the money in order to fund the accounts. You can't really analyze step two, which has some borrowing, in the absence of knowing what goes on in step one, what will happen to the traditional program. And there, the devil really is in the details.
Right. But you've been quoted as saying that you think that it's a good idea to do something, you know, to show that an entitlement program can be reformed.
I think that it is a fair assessment to say that the big programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, merit a lot of attention. Social Security in particular will evolve in a budgetary context where it initially provides a little bit of cushion to the rest of the budget, but over the next decade, that cushion will go away, budgetary dollars will get very tight, and at the point when Social Security starts to run short and come back to the rest of the budget for help, it will face growing demands from Medicare and Medicaid and defense. So it's the combination of those three demands for spending coming at about the same time with the retirement of the baby boom that really makes it advantageous to move now, fix one or more of our long-term budget problems, and make the future a bit easier for both beneficiaries and the budget.
And by the way, which problem? You've been quoted as saying that while Social Security, you know, takes up a lot of the budget, Medicare is the far larger problem.
Right now, Social Security is the single largest federal program, but it will rapidly be overtaken by the combination of Medicare and Medicaid.
Okay.
Social Security rises with the number of beneficiaries and payments per beneficiary. Medicare and Medicaid rise much, much faster. For the same beneficiaries, cost per person, health care costs, are rising very rapidly. And we could imagine those programs getting to be three times as large as they are now, or half of all of current federal spending, or even five times larger, which would be as large as the entire federal budget. Medicare and Medicaid are a big long-term problem.
By the way, we've touched on, you know, the domestic programs and the war, but we haven't yet spoken of President Bush's tax cuts and extending them. Is that included in your projection?
Our projections assume that the current laws prevail. So under our projections, taxes go up in 2009 when dividend and capital gains rates go up. And then in 2011, all of the tax policy between 2001 and the present will expire, and we'll see tax increases again. So our baseline projections assume current law is self-fulfilling. It's obvious that that's at odds with administration policy at the moment.
Right. And by the way, we should point out, though your office is nonpartisan, you are a Republican who's come under some criticism from your own party for not, you know, having a rosier, more optimistic financial picture at times. Give us your headline on this projection.
My headline on this projection is, if you look at last year versus this year, it's a little bit better. But what is next is the key question. And what is next depends on choices made by Congress and the administration. The economy is solid. It's growing nicely. It's not the case that the economy will determine the deficit. The choices that are made in legislation will determine the future, and it's an important set of choices. It's important from a budgetary point of view, and it's really important for these programs that are so central to America's social welfare programs, Social Security and Medicare.
In the few seconds we have, do you worry that some lawmakers might use these figures to cut benefit programs that people really need? I mean, how do you see these figures being used initially?
CBO figures measure the cost of programs. They are silent on the benefits. And, of course, we create government programs specifically for their benefits. Any lawmaker who used CBO figures in a one-sided fashion would, in fact, be misusing them. A proper policy discussion balances the benefits, hard to quantify, with the costs, which are what show up in the budget.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken is director of the Congressional Budget Office. Douglas, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
And still to come, the sour notes of some really passionate opera singers. You're listening to Here and Now. A new study from Liverpool's John Moores University in England has found that the heart of a 70-year-old woman can perform as well as the heart of a 20-year-old. Men are not so lucky. The power of the male heart declines significantly with age. Leading this extraordinary study is Professor of Cell and Molecular Sports Science David Goldspink. I spoke to him recently about his study. Tell us first, your title is, involves sports science. I was wondering, who are these people that you studied? Are they athletes?
No, certainly not. They are ordinary people who volunteered to come on board with the study. We had in excess of 800 volunteers, and we then had to put set requirements or criteria in place, and we restricted that down to some 350 volunteer men and women between the ages of 18 and 80 years of age.
Mm-hmm. And did the older people in particular have any diseases, or were they sort of just normal, healthy people?
No, we ensured that they were selected on the basis of having no known diseases, no medications or food supplements that might interfere with the study. And also we ensured that they were relatively inactive. So that what we were trying to do was to control as far as possible the very varied lifestyle that human beings lead.
So these relatively inactive older women had hearts that could, perform the way a 20-year-old heart could?
Well, an inactive 20-year-old as well, yes.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. And how do you test that?
The heart does two things. It ensures that blood flows around the body appropriately, but it also ensures that there is blood pressure. It maintains blood pressure. Mm. So we measure both blood flow and blood pressure, and we put the two together, and that tells us the power of the heart.
Well, and does this explain why, women can, let's say, work longer later into life while men retire to their recliner and watch football? Oh, wait, I've revealed too much. I mean, what did you learn about how women, are as they get older and how men are?
Well, women actually do have a smaller heart than men, which is just based on the fact that women tend to be smaller in body size and composition than men. The wall of the heart is essentially muscle, and it's made up of millions of these contractile cells. Mm. And over this 50-year period, men lose about one-third of these vital cells. And for some reason in women, they don't get the same cell death. Mm. And therefore, keeping the vital cells enables them to keep the function.
Huh. But is there anything men can do to strengthen their hearts, to change that cell death loss?
Yes, very much so. They have to work harder at keeping good health. If they participate in regular exercise over many years, we have shown in a complementary study that loss of function can be prevented. Hmm. But we can't let women put their feet up and rest. Hmm. Because the muscles associated with the arms and legs will waste and will become weaker as women become older as well. So if they don't keep active and do some exercise, then they may live longer, but they may be less mobile and less capable of doing the average daily task.
Well, Professor Goldspink, tell us, and where does this research lead you? What's next for you?
In the past, scientists and medical researchers like myself have tended to study men in preference to women because they've got a simpler hormonal system, less fluctuations and cycles. But it's a very clear signal that we cannot study men and just assume that the same information applies to women. So we've got to focus very much on more studies for women and their health issues.
David Goldspink is professor of cell and molecular sports science at Liverpool John Moores University in England. Professor Goldspink, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Well, stay with us. A truly commendable yet horrible CD is next. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's not often that a highly respected classical music critic gives a favorable review of a truly awful CD. But that's exactly what the Boston Globe's Richard Dyer did in his review of The Muse Surmounted. He writes, "Nearly all of the singing is awful, but it's an entertaining disc." The Muse Surmounted is a collection of 12 songs sung by aspiring opera singers, wannabes. Here's an example of soprano Florence Foster Jenkins singing a valse caressante. That's Florence Foster Jenkins on the new CD, The Muse Surmounted, a compilation of famously bad singing, and in some cases, famous singing. And it's a CD that gets two thumbs up from Boston Globe classical music reviewer Richard Dyer, who joins us now. Hello.
Hi.
Tell us about Florence Foster Jenkins. Did she know what that note sounded like?
Probably not. I mean, there's some debate about that. But she was a wealthy New York society lady who gave benefit concerts, culminating in a famous concert in Carnegie Hall. And the audience responded with unbridled hilarity. There are those who feel that she didn't know, and that she was expressing the music in her soul. It's not unmusical in the sense that it has feeling. What it doesn't have is tone quality and intonation and all of the things we usually expect to hear from a professional singer.
Well, and there are others singing, as we said, on The Muse Surmounted. Let's listen to another track and learn about this singer, Betty Jo Schramm, singing an aria by Carl Heinrich Graun. Well, you know, it's better than I could do, Richard. And so, you know, I'm in no position to laugh, but how did people like Betty Jo Schramm, Florence Foster Jenkins, how did they mount these productions?
Well, I think each story was different. Florence Foster Jenkins did it for charity. Nothing really is known of Betty Jo Schramm. This record was found in the private collection of Harold Schoenberg, the New York Times music critic for many years, mm-hmm. after his death. And nobody knows where it came from. Nobody knows who she was. But it was somebody ambitious who sent him a record, just as people send me records all the time, but not often as entertaining as this one is.
Save them, apparently.
And the remarkable thing about Betty Jo Schramm is, you know, how almost good she is. Again, it's a rather strange tone quality, and she was ahead of the early music movement in that she was already singing a quarter tone flat before the early music movement came along to teach us to listen a half a tone lower.
Yeah. Let's listen to another track, and as you'll start to hear, what all of these singers have is just a passion for what they're doing that almost makes up for what they might be lacking in skills. This is Natalia D'Andrade singing an aria from Massenet's Manon. Richard Dyer, I have to share with you, I have a chihuahua that sings opera. I don't make him do it. When something particularly warbly comes on, he runs to the couch and climbs up on the back, and you can see him sitting just his little back pear shape facing the stereo. He would love this. tell us Natalia's story.
Well, I don't think we know much about her either. Clearly, she's not a young woman, and her voice is no longer steady or responsive to her wishes. But the diction is intact, and that's what's so hilarious about it. It has this very forward, direct, meaningful diction, you know, applied to an exceedingly disagreeable quality of tone. She really puts out.
And you say in your review of the CD, she sounds a little like Lady Macbeth.
Yes.
As she does so. But I'm wondering, for your trained ear to hear this, how do you listen to this?
Well, it's so far off the radar that you listen to it in its own terms. You know, it's also been done in pop music. I mean, there were really awful people like Mrs. Miller. And part of the fun, I gather, of watching American Idol is listening to is not listening just to Fantasia and the winners, but listening to the people who are really awful.
How hard is it to be awful if you have some musicality?
I think almost impossible. And it takes a real musician to sing purposely out of tune. The people on this record aren't purposely out of tune.
Right.
And some cases it's age. I mean, there's one of the singers on here was probably a great artist, but who at the age of 80 or whatever it was that she made this record was no longer able to sing in any legitimate sense, but she is delivering an interpretation.
Well, we want to leave our listeners, before our listeners leave us, with a little more from The Muse Surmounted. And as we go, though, what's your sense of how this is being listened to? Because we don't think of ourselves here as people who make fun of people. And it almost feels, you know, of course, there's a little bit of that, but you can't help but love these people.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, all of us have an inner voice that sings like Caruso or Pavarotti. And so it's comic in the sense that it's always comic when somebody falls down on a banana peel. But it's also a little bit touching, particularly in the case of the people who didn't really know that they were bad, because there is an inner music in them that has to get out somehow. And it doesn't coincide with the outer music that most of us are used to hearing.
And to carry the banana peel, it's just so heroic when they get back up again.
Yeah.
And with that, let's listen to Norma Jean Erdmann Chadbourn.
Yeah, this is with her husband. It's a duet.
Aida, where can you be?
She can sing, he can't. That's one of the interesting things about this record. I mean, what's funny about that is his very strange diction, his totally non-apparatic timbre, and the stilted, silly translation. And then she comes on, and the other funny thing about it, too, is that this record was issued as a part of a course of vocal study. You're supposed to imitate this and, as a method of singing.
Well, and you have to love her obvious love for him.
Yeah.
Because she overlooked a lot.
I guess she did. That.
Richard Dyer, the classical music critic for the Boston Globe. For more information on the new CD, The Muse Surmounted, go to our website, here-now.org. Bless their hearts. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, please, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.